The Defense Department said it was going to start considering climate change, a major part of its national security planning. That was back in January. Now the department is nearly finished with that strategy. Federal News Network's Scott Mossioni joins me with the latest. And Scott, let's set the background here. Why is DOD taking climate change into account even more than they had been? Because this is something they have been talking about for a few years now, correct?
Yeah, they certainly have. And what this stems from is from an executive order from the White House back in January, on January 27th, to be exact. And that executive order really put climate change as a big factor in a lot of government planning. And the Defense Department was one of those. Now, in the past, there have been climate surveys, Arctic strategies, base resiliency studies, all these sorts of things. But there had never been an actual centralized strategy that said, you know, this is how we're going to take climate change into account for all of our future planning. Climate change, the Defense Department has said, is going to be a huge part of its future threat landscape in terms of bases, base security and resiliency, in terms of how the Arctic is opening up, water resources, extreme weather, pretty much everything that the military has its hands in will be affected by climate change in some way or another.
And they've already seen damage from climate, or at least extreme weather events, in Florida and other locations. So it's not like they don't think anything can happen.
Exactly. I mean, one of the most recent studies that came out was on base resiliency, found that more than 1,000 DOD bases were in some way vulnerable to climate change. And as you said, we've seen Air Force Base Tyndall, which was basically destroyed by Hurricane Michael a couple of years ago. There's other bases that are dealing with rising sea levels, and then others that are just in the way of a lot of these wildfires that are happening out in the West.
So now the new strategy is starting to come out of the oven, you might say, after 6-7 months baking there. What's in it?
Well, the big thing about this is that it's focused on two different things. One is the resiliency of operations and the resiliency of installations. So as we said, making sure that DOD assets stay the way they are and that the DOD can do what it needs to do to protect the nation and continue its operations. The second is reducing environmental harm, which, you know, obviously a lesser concern for the Defense Department, but still one that is important when it comes to saving energy and trying to reduce their footprint. So this study and this strategy has five lines of effort. One of them is climate-informed decision-making, where climate considerations help with the enterprise resource allocations and operational decision-making process. They also want to test, train, and equip a climate-ready workforce. That means that they want all the activities related to developing, fielding, sustaining equipment and services to have some sort of climate idea or climate sensitivity to it. There's another thing about just building a resilient infrastructure when it comes to natural infrastructure or built infrastructure, supply chain resilience and innovation. So DOD wants to be assured that key suppliers and industries can operate while impacted by climate change and they have uninterrupted access to key supplies and materials. And finally, just enhance adaptation and resilience through collaboration. So that means working with their allies and partners to ensure that they can get what they need and that they can still work together in the way that they need to continue operations.
We're speaking with Federal News Network's Scott Mossioni, and they've had scattered efforts going on for some time now, for example, trying to find alternative or bio-based fuels that can operate both efficiently and also safely and reliably in jets. They are training certain elements of the Army to operate in cold climates and hot climates, the extremes that they might encounter in battle situations or expeditionary situations. Does this strategy bring all of those things together in some sort of cogent umbrella?
It really does. And what's really, I think, the most interesting thing about this and the most impactful is that this will inform all of the main parts of the Defense Department strategy. So the future national defense strategies, future chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's ideas on how they think the operation should go forward on things, all of the main documents the Defense Department will put out from the future on will deal with this, at least under the Biden administration. You know, they're also required to have annual reports that they give to the National Security Council so that they can continue to take the climate change ideas and threats into the threat landscape. And this is something that's going to really touch every facet of the military, from training all the way up to the procurement of something like the F-35 or, you know, any whatever the next huge weapon system is.
All right. So what's going to be required of DOD? Just reports, or are there metrics and energy usage and, I don't know, you name it, that the administrations are expected to be able to judge DOD by?
Well, we don't know exactly yet, because this plan is not out and they're not revealing all of their cards yet. However, it will be out by September 1st. We do know that the military services, though, are doing their own things to try and reduce operational energy use and regular energy use, and to make sure that they're resilient. For example, the Air Force, about 80% of their energy use comes from operations and just all the weapon systems that they have. And they're saying that a lot of the small investments that they're doing this year for really less than $40 million are really helping out with what they're doing. For example, angling windshield wipers differently, the little winglets that they have on the end of the airplane wings, modifying those things just to save gas. You know, so this is something that saves money as well as saves, you know, the environment. Another thing is that the Navy is certainly concerned about rising sea levels, considering they have a lot of coastal bases. So, you know, one of the things they're doing is working with the communities that they're in to see what they can do to, you know, build different seawalls, and then just making sure that there's resilience within cyber and other parts of this. They're also running things called black exercises, where they take bases off grids, electrical grids, and see if they can, you know, make their independent power source work. And some of these power sources may be from biodiesel fuels or, you know, solar panels, all those sorts of things. Finally, the Army is saying that they are going to have their own plan coming out in the next 60 days or so about climate change. It'll be really a detailed plan laying out a multi-year effort that covers everything from operating forces to installations.
The presumption in the requirement of this reporting and of the strategizing that the military is doing is that the climate change would have an effect on the military itself. As we said, rising sea levels could affect naval ships and so on. Do they also see it as part of the strategic threat with respect to adversaries? Is there some effect climate has on that that they're also thinking about?
They certainly do. And, you know, when it comes to equipment, I think one of the things that they're trying to build in resiliency is, I mean, if you consider that these, maybe a tank has to go through, you know, lots of different types of weather or whatever, what have you, you know, acid rain will deteriorate a tank much faster. High winds, hurricanes and things like that are hurting a lot of weapon systems. Also, we're seeing that the resources around the world are changing. So a lot of areas within the Arctic are opening up, making Russia go north to find oil and things like that. There will also be droughts in places like Africa and the Middle East and within Asia, which will cause a rush for water resources. So there's plenty of different things that will change the way the world acts, and definitely the threat and security structure of the world the way it is right now.
Well, we can't wait till the Ice Age returns, and then we'll see how everybody reacts. Federal News Network, Scott Mossioni, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Check out his story at federalnewsnetwork.com.
Hello, and welcome to the Lessons in Leadership podcast. I am your host, Shane Canfield, CEO of WEPA. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Vice Admiral Cutler Dawson. Cutler has had an incredible career serving our country for 35 years in the Navy, where he attained the rank of Vice Admiral. During his service, he had numerous assignments afloat and ashore, including Commander, Second Fleet, Striking Fleet Atlantic, and in Washington at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, where he was the Navy's Chief of Legislative Affairs. Immediately following his retirement from active duty in 2004, he became the president and CEO of Navy Federal Credit Union, the world's largest credit union, where he served for 14 years. Under his leadership, Navy Federal grew from 2 million to 8 million members. Phenomenal. Cutler, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Shane.
You've had a fascinating career across both military and the private sector. Can you tell us a little bit more about your background and your professional journey?
Well, I started out at the Naval Academy, where I graduated in 1970, and then, as you mentioned, spent 35 years in the Navy, with six actual afloat commands. The first one was when I was 27 years old. I didn't know enough to be scared of anything, and it was probably one of the highlights of my career. And then after I retired after 35 years, I went to work at Navy Federal Credit Union as the CEO, where I spent my next 14 years. I'm currently retired and enjoying life, and it's been a great run for me.
How would you describe your leadership style, and how's that developed over the years?
My style has been quite consistent. I believe, and I learned this in the Navy, that you have to go to the deck plates to see what is going on. And you have to learn what your people do and how they do it so you can help them to be better at it and more efficient and more productive. It's something that you need to do all the time. I remember I used to tell folks that you don't want to retreat to your cabin. And what I mean by that is the longer you're in a position, the less you think you have to get out and about. But that should be the opposite. You should get out and about more, because people change, situations change, and you've got to figure out a way to get to them and find out what they're doing and what you can do to help them.
We'll talk a little bit more about your book, but I read it, From Sea to the C-Suite. Fantastic read. You talk about the deck plates in that as well. I would encourage everyone to get a copy of this and read some more detail about going to the deck plates. Cutler, who was the most impactful leader in your life, and what quality did you admire about them?
I had numerous while I was in the Navy, but the quality that I enjoyed the most was the leaders that got to know me as an individual, and that they cared about me, and I could tell that they cared about me. And they were not only my leaders, but they were my mentors. And I remember one particular one, Bill Schiffer, when I had my first assignment at the Pentagon. I would go in to see him with my problem of the day, and I knew that he had numerous problems of his own, but he would stop, and he would focus on me, and he would make me feel like I was the most important person in his world. And I tried to do that throughout my career. But really, it's about caring for your people.
Cutler, in reading your book, there was a quote you used that you used to inspire those people that work for you. And it really got my attention. And it was, you are the captain of your own ship. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what that means and how it was useful to you and the leaders you were developing.
Absolutely. What I mean by captain of your own ship, when you are the captain of a ship, sometimes you're in the middle of the ocean and you don't have anybody to turn to make decisions. You don't have anybody to turn to ask, what should I do now? You have to be the captain of that ship. And I translated that into, let's say, Navy Federal's organization, where I would tell branch managers that I said, you are the captain of the ships of Navy Federal. You're the ones that are facing the members or customers, as others call them, every day. And you have to make decisions without a lot of guidance in some cases and without a lot of time. So be the captain of your own ship. Step up, make decisions, do what you think is right, and you never can go wrong.
I think that is so important. And you have to give your people a little bit of latitude to take some risk as well, because there is risk for them in doing that and risk to your organization.
That's right. And I mentioned that I took command of my first ship with 5 years in the Navy, and I was 27 years old. Well, my boss had 32 years in the Navy, and his guidance to me when I first met him was, Cutler, you do the right thing and I'll back you up all the way. What a wonderful way to spend an assignment with backup and guidance like that.
What great advice. It's clear leadership is a topic you're passionate about. You wrote the book we mentioned before, From Sea to C-Suite. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Yes. When I was at Navy Federal, I would tell sea stories as parables to get my point across. And folks would tell me, Cutler, we like your stories. It gives us a picture of what you're trying to tell us. Now, what else are they going to say? They work for me, but I took it as a compliment, and it was. And my wife encouraged me to write a book, and I needed a co-author to help me, and I found a lady named Taylor Keelan, who was the perfect co-author. She turned in my stories into wonderful chapters that I'm very proud of.
Where can listeners find a copy?
Well, you can get it on Amazon, and you can also get it on the Naval Institute website. And I might add that any proceeds from the book, Navy Federal uses to give to charity.
Fantastic. Cutler, thank you very much. Really enjoyed your time and your lessons and in leadership and sharing with us your life story. And I've learned a lot both from talking to you today and reading your book. And thank you very much for your time.
It's my pleasure. And I would like to add one thing if I could, Shane. During my assignments in Washington, D.C., I gained the utmost respect for the civilians that work here every day. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, and they have my eternal gratitude. I got to come and go from the Pentagon. They stayed every day and worked in Washington when I got to go out and enjoy being at sea.
Perfect. Thank you. Yeah, WAPO serves civilian federal employees, but your comment is well taken because the interaction between the two is continuous, it's nonstop, and it's critical. So the career civil servants, as well as career military, our country would not be where it is today without them.
I totally agree. And I can tell you from the U.S. Navy standpoint, we couldn't operate like we do without them being the backbone of what we do.
Thank you very much for your time today, Cutler. And to everyone listening to Lessons in Leadership podcast, we'll see you next time.